Today on the 21st Show, the Trump administration says it wants to limit private equity firms buying single-family homes. It's aimed at easing a tight housing market and rising prices. We'll hear about what it's like to buy a house from private equity, talk about what all this could mean for Illinois home buyers, and check in on home prices statewide. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WNIJ in Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Before we get to today's program on the housing market in Illinois, I want to begin with some news this morning. Per reporting from WCIA-TV, there was a sentencing hearing about an hour ago for former Sangamon County Sheriff's Deputy Sean Grayson, who was convicted of second-degree murder in the shooting death of Sonia Massey in her home outside Springfield. This morning, a Sangamon County judge sentenced Grayson to the maximum 20 years. Stay tuned to this NPR station for updates on that story later today. All right, on with the program. For decades, it's been considered the American dream to own your own home, but statistics show that for many people, it's staying a dream, not a reality. According to the National Association of Realtors, first-time home buyers accounted for 21% of all buyers in the last year, which used to have a historic norm of about 40% back before the Great Recession. Meanwhile, the median age of first-time buyers is 40, the highest on record. Now, there are many reasons why this is the case. For one, mortgage rates currently average nearly 7%. A quarter of the homes purchased were all cash. There's high rent, and there are student loans keeping people from saving as much as they might want to for their housing. Another reason is that there are individuals, corporations, and private equity firms that buy up housing or invest in housing and lease it out to people. It's been a problem for some time now, and it's even caught the attention of the White House. Earlier this month, President Trump said he would have his administration look into preventing companies from buying up single-family homes in an effort to bring down house prices. It's something Democrats have also pushed for. With that in mind, we're going to talk about how realistic this policy is, why this has become an issue, and what are other drivers of the tight housing market, and what prices look like in one downstate community. We begin this morning with Rebecca Burns, housing editor for In These Times, a Chicago-based publication. Rebecca, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can join us throughout the hour today at 800-222-9455. Maybe you have been on the housing market or a participant in the housing market recently. Have you tried to buy? Have you tried to sell? What have you seen out there? Maybe you feel sort of tied by because you got one of those great low mortgage rates during the pandemic. Let us know what your situation is. 800-222-9455. All right, Rebecca, you have done reporting on this. Talk about private equity and, you know, sort of corporations in housing. How long has that been a thing?
Yeah, so this is a trend that we really see taking off in the wake of the foreclosure market when private equity firms, investment firms, sort of initially led by the Blackstone Group, came into markets that had been hard hit for by foreclosures and began buying up often vacant single-family homes at cheap prices and turning them into rentals. So there were concerns at the time about rising rents, but I think from my reporting then, actually some of the most meaningful dynamics were the ways that we saw these type of actors pioneering some of the practices around, you know, imposing junk fees, lease terms that shifted maintenance costs into tenants. And those types of dynamics have now become much more mainstream in the rental market.
So those are some of the disadvantages. Were there advantages? I mean, were people at all like seeing the bright side of these? Because I do remember a lot of talk about, you know, concerns about whole neighborhoods becoming vacant, that sort of thing during the Great Recession.
Yeah, so folks who would point to positive aspects of this trend, I think would say, these are actors that at the time were very well capitalized to make improvements to homes that perhaps had been sitting empty and were being damaged. There's also some research showing that, introducing rentals in what were previously, mostly homeowner-dominated neighborhoods, has led to some integration and created new opportunities. I think to those points, I would point back again to some of the downsides of what the experience of renting actually has been. But that's usually what folks will talk about when they sort of point to advantages of this type of actor coming into housing markets.
Yeah, well, let's get into that then. So what are some of the experiences of, some of the stories you've heard from people who've rented from, either corporations or private equity firms or even, I guess, mom and pop investors?
Sure. One thing I'll point to is that I think, we can talk about whether corporate landlords themselves are, driving some of the issues that we see in the housing market. A point I'll make is that if we look to what corporate landlords themselves are telling investors about why they're buying in the areas that they're buying, it can tell us a lot about, some of the deeper structural problems in the housing market. So while we initially saw, groups like the Blackstone Group coming pretty heavily into Chicago, into some areas of Illinois, they've shifted a lot of their acquisitions over time and pretty quickly following sort of the peak of the foreclosure crisis into Sun Belt states, into places where there's more opportunities to quickly hike rents, where regulations are friendlier to landlords, they can file evictions more quickly. And that's where we see people, again, having really a lot of problems with lease terms that in some cases are being challenged legally, that sort of put folks in the position of having the worst of both worlds of being, a rent owner, but in some cases, being asked to take on maintenance duties that, you'd expect more of a homeowner, being charged junk fees that sort of add hidden costs above and beyond the rental price advertised. And particularly, and there's quite a bit of research on this, really aggressive eviction filings that even if they don't result, in an actual court-ordered eviction, tack on fees and can kind of put a black mark on their rental record that makes it really difficult to find new housing.
So in response, one of the things that you've covered is the rise of tenant unions. So tell me about that and the role that's played of, these groups working with their landlords.
Sure, yeah. So I think tenant unions are proliferating at the moment, and I think are an attempt in a lot of cases to borrow tactics that we see in workplaces to sort of redistribute some power. An individual tenant does not have a lot of bargaining power with their landlord. We can talk a little bit more about this problem of corporate consolidation, but certainly someone working with tenants across their building has more power to challenge unfair lease terms, to demand maintenance that may be contractually required but isn't getting done, and that there's no sort of meaningful redress for from their city or regulatory body, have more power to address those by working with others in the same situation.
So some renters have even taken to striking against their landlords. How does that work?
That's right. This is not a completely new tactic, but it is something that we're seeing happening more. Again, sometimes against, what we would consider corporate or private equity landlords, sometimes not. And in some cases, extracting some pretty meaningful concessions. There are already in certain cities rules, landlord-tenant regulations that allow tenants to legally withhold rent when their landlord, isn't holding up their end of the bargain in terms of making a home habitable. But a lot of places either don't have those types of regulations, or tenants still end up in eviction court when they do everything right. Here in Chicago, in places like Kansas City, in the Bay Area, we've seen successful examples of tenants coming together and saying, as a group, We're withholding rent until you come to the table and tell us when is the boiler going to be fixed. If you're telling us we have a 20% rent increase next year, what improvements are going into that? Explain the math. We want to negotiate over this.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners we are talking with Rebecca Burns, who's housing editor at In These Times, which is a I didn't characterize it earlier. If people aren't familiar, it's I think this is fair to say, correct me if I'm wrong, a progressive magazine covers politics, labor, and social justice movements. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. 800-222-9455. So can you tell me a little more? I read a story that you did. I think it was through CUNY. A few years back, of a woman who had just like kind of an awful experience. She and her partner were trying to rent to own. And what was it actually like, sort of day to day living in a home that's owned by, a fund, basically?
Sure, yeah. So in that case, I was covering a segment of the market known as rent to own. And I think this is an important point, when we discuss this order on corporate landlords, that a lot of sources I talk to, would say that it's not just single family homes, and that that's an important point, that single family homes were sort of a beachhead for a lot of these types of actors to expand into the other areas of the housing markets. But often we see even bigger issues. In this case, I was covering rent-to-own contracts in the apartment market, in affordable housing, and really especially in manufactured housing. So at these lower ends of the housing market where people really might not have other good options. So in the particular story I was covering, a spin-off that it's since sold, but at the time was also owned by the Blackstone group called Homes of America, was offering folks who were having difficulty purchasing a home another potential path to home ownership. Is that sort of problematic on its face? No, not necessarily. There are a lot of people for whom there isn't a good path to home ownership, and this sort of purported to offer them the opportunity to, pay rent for a few years, fix their credit, develop savings, and then if they still wanted to, buy at the end. The issue, that I sort of alluded to earlier is putting this people in this position where they have sort of the worst worlds of being both a tenant and a homeowner, that there are sometimes these, very complex, legalistic, sort of not understandable to the average person terms, both governing the sale and governing, their maintenance requirements, and they live there. So the person I talked to, her name was Erica Denson. She was, recovering from a bankruptcy following a divorce, had a good job as a nurse, was trying to repair her credit, and building a blended family with a new husband. Sort of from the moment she moved into this home, which she had hoped to buy, it hadn't undergone an inspection that was visible to her. So more and more problems with the electric kept popping up. She had to buy a new refrigerator. All of these out-of-pocket costs that she really wasn't clear. Is this my responsibility? Is this not? And that the particular company, and this is something I hear often, was sort of impossible to get in touch with. Eventually, when she fell a month behind on rent on the pandemic, she was locked out of her automatic payment portal. This is also quite common. And then those late fees, those attorney fees that are sort of hidden in, I think it was a 80-page contract, started piling up really fast, and she just couldn't get caught up. Ended up in eviction court. They wouldn't accept a partial payment. So eventually had to move out, and was sort of worse off, arguably, than when she started. Her credit had gotten worse again. She had paid all this money out of pocket, and she had to move out really rapidly to avoid, the sheriff coming to her door at the height of the pandemic.
Let me share a couple of messages we got from listeners this morning. This is by text message. Tony in Champaign says, "I think there are fundamental problems with the way we handle real estate, and that one of these days we'll work out a permanent fix. Till then, we're going to suffer." All right. Thank you for that dose of optimism, Tony. We also heard from Adrienne in Carbondale, who says, I actually think that sounds like a fantastic idea. I should say this was in response to Trump having the federal government look into trying to restrict private equity purchases. I don't agree with much Trump does, but I do think private equity is the main force behind the housing crisis. Homeownership has made my family feel financially stable by letting us save compared to what we would spend on renting. And I wish that for others as well. Do you have a take on President Trump's sort of entrance into the housing the housing debate in America?
Yeah, look, I mean, this is pretty clearly an attempt by Trump to show that he's taking affordability seriously. This is not a totally new idea. As I mentioned, this was a big concern among housing activists more on the left in the wake of the foreclosure crisis. We've seen the right latch onto it, you know, especially in 2021. There was a viral tweet, about BlackRock buying homes that, you know, J.D. Vance sort of took notice of because it fit into his, narrative around sort of anti-DEI, anti-ESG. And I will say, you know, the formulation certainly that, BlackRock in particular buying homes, it's become kind of a meme, is wrong on the facts. And the overall trend of corporate ownership of single family homes certainly is sometimes overstated. But I think it'd be a mistake to discuss this as a really troubling trend that, you know, goes hand in hand with the growth of inequality in recent years.
Inequality. Is that the real story in your view here about why we have the housing problem that we have now?
I think so. You know, as I mentioned, in some ways, the private equity and other actors, that came into the housing market in the wake of the foreclosure crisis, you know, they're telling us why they're doing this. It's because there's a huge opportunity to raise rents, to shift maintenance costs with very little regulation. I think that's also related to the reason that we're seeing the growth of tenant unions, that there's this structural imbalance in people's ability to, you know, maintain their basic needs. And corporate landlords are sort of the most dramatic example of where we see that basic need sort of, you know, being yoked to investor expectations for high returns.
Hmm. Well, we will continue to watch what happens here. Rebecca Burns is housing editor for In These Times. Thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st Show. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to continue this conversation after a short break with a couple other perspectives on the housing market, especially here in Illinois. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. More to come. This is the 21st Show. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the housing market and efforts to help alleviate some of the high prices individuals are paying for single-family homes, if they can even get into one. The Trump administration recently announced it would look into banning corporate and private equity investors from buying up homes in an effort to alleviate housing prices that have surged in recent years. We heard from listeners about this. I should say, if you want to join our texting group, talk to 217-803-0730 is how to do that. Text the word talk to 217-803-0730. Gina in Springfield says historic norms could perhaps be achieved again if more potential first-time home buyers were employed in stable, well-paying jobs. People of all ages know better than to purchase a home without some assurance that they can find employment and pay for the home. This is a complicated topic touching on many aspects of contemporary American life. So we're going to continue our conversation today with Reagan Pratt, who is the Douglas and Cynthia Crocker Endowed Director of the DePaul University Real Estate Center, one of those excellent higher ed titles. Reagan, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Eric Zwiff, the Joel F. Gemunder, Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. Eric, I hope I didn't butcher that too badly. Welcome to you as well.
No, I'm happy to be here and happy with your attempt.
Listeners, you can join us today, 800-222-9455. So, Professor Reagan Pratt, I'll start with you. Generally speaking, what do you think of this idea of trying to stop, you know, corporations, private equity from buying up single family homes?
Well, look, I think anecdotes make good news and good radio, but they make lousy policy. And so it's always easy to come up with, and all of the stories are true, no doubt, well-researched. But the fact of the matter is we kind of work from empirical numbers. And I'll throw out some numbers, and I don't want to bore people with numbers, but there's probably roughly 14 million single-family rental houses in America today. And about that's about 28% of all rental houses. And of that 14 million, the people that the policy seeks to ban, they own less than 500,000 of those. So the idea that we're going to move the needle on affordability by saying Blackstone can't buy a house is preposterous. And, you know, reality again, they've been net sellers of houses for a while, almost all the corporate owners, for about at least 18 months. Because they bought a bunch of stuff from the GFC that wasn't efficient. It was all over the place. And now they're trying to build new purpose-built single-family rental, get efficient in certain markets like the Sun Belt, and then operate them efficiently. So if you look at the numbers, nobody gets popular defending private equity. So it's an easy straw man. But the fact of the matter is it's performative and not really going to have a big effect.
GFC, for our listeners, global financial crisis. Eric Zwick, what do you think of President Trump's sort of top line reaction to this attempt?
Yeah, so I agree with Reagan's assessment. I think it's largely a distraction from kind of, you know, probably the harder to solve actual problems driving housing affordability. I mean, just to put those stats into even broader perspective, say, you know, Reagan said that it's less than 1% of all single family rentals are owned by these firms, but it's probably maybe 0.1 or 0.2% of the single family housing stock if you include owner occupied single family housing. So if we want to think about what's driving house prices, or, you know, the ability for people to afford that down payment, get into a first time home, ruling out these folks from the housing market is really rounding error. So I completely agree with that assessment.
Well, that's a good pivot then to say, what is pricing people out of the housing market right now? Why is it so challenging for so many people from the, you know, the housing market perspective, setting aside, you know, their, you know, personal financial conditions?
Yeah. So, I mean, real house prices have gone up a lot, over not just the last 5 years, but if you go back even to like the 1980s, more so in coastal markets than in Illinois, but even in Chicago, which has lagged the national market, we're probably 50% higher in real terms relative to 1980. And if you think about, you know, price to income ratios, those kinds of things, sort of like the typical affordability measure that takes also into account not just the price of housing, but financing it. So mortgage rates, insurance costs, taxes, housing affordability. So the, you know, just how much out of pocket is going to housing is probably at the levels that it was in the housing bubble, maybe a bit below where it was at the peak of the mortgage rates in the early 1980s. But we're at a time where kind of the cost of housing, both in terms of prices and in terms of mortgages, is very high. And what's driving that is broad-based demand from a lot of segments of the economy. That's outpacing sort of limited constrained supply, especially in places where people want to live. Sort of my take. And we could talk about those drivers, but I'll stop there.
Yeah. Well, Reagan Pratt, anything you want to add to that, or we can carry forward?
No, I think, Eric, now that I tend to focus as much on the supply side, and depending what estimate you look at over a period of time, we're probably 2 to 4 million housing units short in this country. And we can go through the list of reasons why that would be. You know, single family builders have almost exclusively stopped building for the entry level market because they just can't afford it, whether it's student debt, whether it's income distribution. So I think one of the callers right before you introduced myself and Eric said this is a really complicated problem that deals with the ability to buy, and that's an income issue. And you know, what I thought was funny or interesting about the president's idea on limiting corporate ownership of single family rentals, he failed to highlight one of the successes since he's been in office is that real incomes have actually outpaced the price of homes and rents and inflation over that brief period of time. And that's really the victories we need coupled with new supply.
Well, new supply. So say more about that. Maybe this is the time then we should turn to what would be some of the more effective ways to make houses more affordable and accessible again.
Yeah, and look, I think we need to, there's a couple of things we need to keep consistent in our mind. There's dwelling type, which is a single family home, and there's tenure type, which is rent or own. And I think that housing is a basic human right. And everybody deserves a roof over their head, whether you choose to own or rent. There's a whole bunch of different calculus there. But to me, any new supply is actually going to alleviate overall affordability one way or another. And one of the things that I think is overlooked in this, Wall Street owning housing is they've been actually massive purchasers of built to rent housing. So purpose built single family rentals in the suburbs has been a really important supply in certain markets in the Sun Belt where supply had been constrained. So I think it's limiting that, and the policy doesn't say it's going to do that, is already, you know, a problem. But we can get into, and I don't want to belabor this, Eric probably has some thoughts as well, but there's a whole bunch of reasons we don't supply enough housing in America, and it's some of it's policy driven, and mostly the feds can't do much about it other than interest rates.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Is it one of those areas where government is quite limited, at least federal government, in what it can do? And maybe, Eric, yeah, pick up from there. What else do you have to say about the what would be an effective solution here?
Yeah, well, I mean the challenge is you want to have new housing units, and I completely agree with Reagan about, you know, whether it's rental housing or owner occupied housing, you know, the having more space for people to live. In the places where they want to live that are productive places for them to work and so on, should be the top priority. And permission to increase the number of places for people to live, for permission to build, is typically not a federal decision, right? It's a state, local decision, especially local decision, permitting, zoning, local infrastructure and so on. And they're typically in most cities, many decision points. So the process of entitling land for or rehabilitating land, repurposing land or, you know, sort of low density properties for higher density uses and so on. There are a lot of veto points. And so we need a streamlined process for approval in production. And that kind of needs to happen at the local level. And maybe there are ways for federal entities to provide incentives to encourage local entities to streamline those processes. But I think without that kind of focus on local decision-making, we're going to have trouble delivering the supply that we need.
Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We are talking about the housing market in Illinois in the context of President Trump's announcement that he wants to limit private equity and corporate investment in housing, which, as we've heard, is ultimately a pretty small share of the housing market nationwide. We're talking about this with Reagan Pratt, who's a professor at DePaul University and director of the DePaul University Real Estate Center, and Eric Zwick, a professor at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. 800-222-9455. What about, Reagan, I just want to bounce an anecdote off you. I have a friend who has so this is a friend of a friend, and I'll leave it at that. But it's in a central Illinois city, people getting rejected for their home purchase offers in favor of all cash payments. And this is happening repeatedly, I've heard. Presumably some share of those are investment buyers. Do you have a sense of whether this is a big issue or a small issue or some local peculiarity?
I don't think it's a local peculiarity. I think it goes back to one of the constraints on home ownership right now is the cost and availability of mortgage debt. And I don't think you have to go to a central Illinois town. I live in Lincoln Square, and most of the houses I'm seeing transact in the neighborhood, anecdotally, from the brokers are cash offers, because that tends to be the folks that are in the market for a lot of these houses, is that they're either they're move-up buyers, essentially. So I don't think that in and of itself, that's a new phenomenon. I think sellers will always take the most likely to close buyer. And in this market, the lack of availability of mortgages for many first time or even move up buyers, or even the cost of them, is making it so those with cash are going to, you know, win the day.
But it is, I mean, I guess, Eric Zwick, that does get to the idea that home buyers tend to be older now. There's you know, less of these starter homes. Can you expound on that?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You have, I mean, people who can afford to fully fund a purchase with all cash, maybe because they, you know, got a huge bonus, they just have accumulated tons of savings, they've done well in the stock market, maybe they've sold a business, and there are, you know, hundreds of thousands just in the, you know, greater Chicago area of people, there are tens of thousands of people who have like these kinds of really high incomes that we don't necessarily read about as much, and across the country, and they're able to, you know, if you're looking at an offer at a similar price, to Reagan's point, they're able to make an offer and say, look, you can close, you don't have to worry about me securing a mortgage, which takes, you know, some time to approve, to apply, maybe falls through because of some, you know, lender inspection component. And so like the tie is going to break in favor of that. All cash buyers can tend to be an older person, maybe somebody buying a second home. I think these are, you know, this is a mass market phenomenon of like sort of the mass affluent top 10 percenters who are, you know, maybe retiring, relocating, changing. They can move the market. Maybe they're buying homes for their kids. This kind of stuff can move in submarkets where there's not a lot of supply. And existing supply is limited also because folks who bought in the last 5 years at fairly high prices, but with very good mortgages, don't want to give those mortgages up because you can't move with your mortgage in the U.S. market.
So you don't want to
proposals
trade that
2%. That allow people to move would move their mortgages might loosen up supply in the existing housing market.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't heard about that. Well, that I had not heard about that concept of moving with your mortgage. But what about this idea? One thing I have heard is President Trump again toyed with this idea of a 50-year mortgage. Eric, what do you think of that?
Right. So the 50-year mortgage, if you want to compare it to a 30-year mortgage, all it does is it stretches out the amount of time for which you can pay down that mortgage. So you're paying a little bit of principal every period. With the 50-year, you're paying a little bit less. You're paying kind of a bit more interest probably, but like the overall monthly payment is maybe slightly lower. I don't think it's like that consequential. It's not going to move the needle very much in one direction or the other. And I think to our earlier conversation about housing affordability, it has no effect on supply. It maybe increases demand a little bit, so then prices will go up a little bit on the margin. But I feel like, again, it's a bit of a sideshow distraction from kind of the more fundamental issues.
Reagan, Pratt, do you think, is real estate still a good investment in America?
It's interesting because when I teach my undergraduates, I do build a straw man at times and say, you know, your grandma said you were throwing money down the rat hole if you didn't own your own home. And so you obviously, you need to buy a home as soon as you can. And that is sort of the accumulated wisdom. And I'm not saying it was incorrect. You know, Eric will know if you look at the numbers historically, home ownership was a pretty good investment. One, because you could lever it. Two, because you could get a mortgage. But today, I just look at the Raymond James numbers. And if you look at the rent for an average institutional single family rental, it's about $2,400 a month. To buy that equivalent home is about $3,500 a month. So you have to be convinced that that difference of $1,000 a month, if I put that in the stock market and rented my house, would I be better or worse? So it's not just the simple analysis of does housing go up? So long answer, I think it's an individual decision based on a lot of things. And just kind of, you know, touching on what Eric said about the 50-year mortgage, if indeed you're going to buy a house and move every 7 years, the 50-year mortgage is actually a massive negative because you're not building equity on the front end and you're paying more interest. So from a long-term investment perspective, most people don't live in their houses 50 years or 30 or 15. And so you're really losing the investment incentive when you start to stretch out the debt payments that way.
Mm, Interesting. Well, Reagan Pratt is the director of the DePaul University Real Estate Center. Eric Zwick is professor of economics and finance at the University of Chicago. Thank you both for taking the time to share your knowledge with us today on the 21st Show.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Coming up after the break, we're going to check in on home prices in one particular Illinois housing market and what the real estate situation looks like there. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. We're heading to Peoria after the break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Throughout the hour today, we've been talking about the housing market and how many people are being priced out of buying a home. This is because, in part, wages haven't kept up with housing prices. Company investors have been buying homes to rent out to people. And more importantly, there just aren't enough vacant homes to meet demand. But that's not equally true in every part of Illinois. Joining me now is Angie Ostashevsky. By day, she's a clean energy professional, but more to the point of our conversation, she's based in Peoria, Illinois, and is known on TikTok for posting about the Peoria housing market and trying to entice TikTokers to move to the community. She joins me now to talk about, I should say TikTok viewers, not necessarily content creators. She joins me now to talk about how the Peoria housing market is looking these days. Angie, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thank you.
So how big of an issue is private equity or corporate, sort of buying up homes in the Peoria area?
We see it quite a bit in the developing areas, the warehouse district. There's also quite a few lots that folks bought several years ago. They went back to California and they sit on them waiting for them to appreciate. But when you do that in the most affordable mid-sized city in the country, it's a bit odd of a choice, I think, because our housing, while it's increased in price very slightly, it's far behind what we're seeing across the rest of the country. It was an interesting point earlier that rent is more affordable than a monthly mortgage payment because it's the opposite where I live. My rent payments, this was 10 years ago, were $800 to $900. And my first home in Peoria, which I bought on a 10-year mortgage, had a $300 monthly payment.
Wow. So talk about what have prices of homes been looking like more recently?
We're still seeing, it depends on the part of town. So those suburbs where you saw a lot of white flight in the 70s, those have been increasing in a more comparable way to the rest of the country. But if you're looking at Central and South Peoria, we're still seeing 3-bed, 2-bath homes for less than $150,000. I myself am preparing to move into a new home where my all-in mortgage payment will be $1,000. And even with rising energy prices, there's still costs that we can control.
So do you find there are enough homes for the people who want to buy them in Peoria?
Most certainly. But there's also studies such as one from University of Kansas from 2024 that suggests that of the nation's 381 metropolitan areas, only 19 of them have a shortage of housing. I really think what we have here is not an income issue or a housing stock issue. It's an access issue.
What do you mean by that, access issue?
So I heard several comments about income being a barrier to housing, and I would have to disagree. If you can pay rent, you can pay a mortgage. But there are barriers in place that make it very challenging for many of the folks I work with in my day job and in my personal life. For example, you have to be employed for 2 years. With the state of unemployment in the country right now, it's going to be a lot less folks who have that kind of background to be approved. I've seen people having to co-sign, leveraging themselves so that others in their community who have a decent income but work for themselves, or they're freelance, or they have multiple jobs, can't get approved because they don't have a traditional 9-to-5 with documentation for 24 months.
So we spoke on the program, 2-3 years ago now? Gosh, it's hard to believe time is a flat circle in the pandemic since the pandemic, but... You were at the time doing what you are doing again now, which is, you know, doing TikTok videos about like these amazing finds in Peoria, trying to entice people to move there. How's that project been going?
Excellent. There's a rise in people moving, not just for the affordability, but with the administration. Folks are looking for the most progressive and most affordable state, and that's Illinois. So we've seen over 1,500 people move since I started in October 2020. It's probably more, but I don't like to count those that don't talk to me. But we're still seeing people come for that independence and lower cost of living. But there's an additional layer there of seeking protection and something that they own, not just to have generational wealth, but there's actually a very strong prevalence of preppers in the community that comes to Peoria. They're interested in grid independence. They're interested in land and property ownership. They are focused on protection and safety and having the resources to be comfortable to be able to enjoy life no matter what happens around them. And I think there's a mental aspect to home ownership that really can change your life when you're a marginalized person. To have a place that is your own, there's just no way to describe it. If you've always had that, getting that for the first time is transformative in more ways than just financially.
Wait a minute. So, okay, I want to pick up on something you said there because I think it could give slid past people. Preppers. This is like people who are concerned about the, you know, the apocalypse or the collapse of the financial system or something like that. So they have, you know, buckets of meals ready to eat in the basement kind of thing and chickens in the backyard. Say more about that.
Exactly. You know, we're in late stage capitalism. There is a climate crisis. There's social unrest. And so we're seeing people that are not who you imagine in a doomsday prepper. Young millennials, especially young queer millennials coming, they have been learning survival skills, canning. They have their own gardens. And because they're somewhere more affordable where they can have land, they're really building self-sufficient systems. I have people who have on-site servers. There are folks who, again, Illinois has some of the best incentives in the nation for solar and renewables. So if you want to be off the grid, not dependent on anyone, and even selling your excess energy back to the utility, you can do that here.
That's so interesting because I think the, you know, the common idea, you say prepper, and even if you look at like the magazines you find at the grocery store, Prepper Monthly or whatever they're called, that is not the typical profile of the person, right? It's more the Duck Dynasty character with the big beard, you know, middle-aged, older white person sort of thing.
Nope. Just tabletop gamers with a finished basement. When they're not hiding from a tornado, they can put, I don't know, 100 gallons of water down there.
All right. Are there any particularly memorable stories of people who relocated because of your, you know, sort of TikTok videos?
Gosh. I think one I learned recently that made me really happy was there was a family that moved back in 2020, and they've been able to save up enough money that they were able to move into a larger home and have more children. And now they're selling their first Peoria home. And what I love is the pay it forward mentality. I don't want to exploit the next person because I got a good deal. It's a leave it better than you found it mentality. And it's a joy to see people celebrating that. Let's just acknowledge. When you have enough money from paycheck to paycheck, everything is easier. And so hearing them say, our mental health was better, we had more bandwidth to focus on things like growing our family, that's what we want to see. People always talk about folks leaving Peoria, leaving Illinois. But what we're looking at around the country, it reminds me in some ways, in the pharmaceutical industry, people often talk about, you don't want to cure an illness, you just want to treat it for the rest of someone's life. And there's no better way to profit off of someone than making them dependent on you for a basic need. And that's what happens when you become a lifelong renter instead of having the ability to build any equity.
How do you balance presenting, you know, Peoria, like any other mid to large size city, has certainly as a metropolitan area, has big city issues, while also promoting its benefits?
It's such a good question because so many people immediately think of crime when they think of Peoria. But my question is, where are you coming from? What's the crime rate there? It's either higher or lower. It's all relevant based on the community you're coming from. There's no perfect choice. But if you want a choice where it takes 15 minutes to drive everywhere, where you can purchase a home on a 15-year mortgage, where you're surrounded by other people who relocated there to participate in their community, and you know, you're home of Richard Pryor and it plays in Peoria. There's a lot of history, whiskey distilleries, beautiful architectural, historic housing. I mean, it checks a lot of the boxes, right? Even if it's not all the boxes that could possibly exist.
Are the people you see coming to Peoria now, are they coming from, you know, across town, out in the county, elsewhere in Illinois, out of state?
Almost never Illinois. It's interesting. There's more of a local reputation within the state, but also comparably affordable cities. What we're seeing is the South, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida. Previously, I was seeing a lot of relocation from Texas and California. Texas has been steady, but California has not. I really think it's driven by cost, but also, again, people with transgender children, people who are worried about what can I be protected by at the state level if things change federally. And it's that's a very scary place to be in life planning, but it makes me feel very fulfilled for people to know there's even one option in the U.S. they could afford to relocate to.
I want to share another text message from a listener. Chris in Rock Falls said, I sold my previous house to avoid foreclosure after the passing of my partner. The housing market was awful at that time, and I sold it significantly less than we paid. I took the proceeds from the equity and bought a small house for $18,900. It was in livable condition, and I've worked hard to make it comfortable and functional. Best of all, it's paid off, and my property taxes are pretty low compared to most. My home's value has more than doubled since I bought it in 2016, but I don't plan on selling anytime soon. Angie, is that the sort of story? I mean, have you heard stories like that in Peoria as well?
Yes, that's my story. I paid off my first home in 5 years, and being able to sell that, now I'm somewhere comfortable. I have my nephew can live with me now. And I'm finally in a place in my career where I can intentionally live below my means and have money to help my family, my friends, my community. But also, we are often trained to think it is too difficult to own a home. But just as the person who wrote in said, also congratulations, I'm so happy for you. You can teach yourself almost anything. Again, there's almost no fundamental difference, because when you're renting, you typically see the split incentive issue. Who's going to fix the problems, the person living there or the person who owns it? And there's always that tension. But when it's yours, it's yours.
We got a text from a listener, Karen, in Champaign, who wants to know if the LGBTQ preppers are also building communities of mutual aid. I don't know if you can speak to that.
Absolutely. We have a Facebook group. We've got over 1,000 members now, and it's become a very organic mutual aid network.
Maybe we should explain to people who aren't as familiar or haven't listened to our segment on that from the past what mutual aid is.
Ah, yes. It is charity that cuts out the middleman. So a lot of us donate to nonprofits, but if we really look locally, we can donate directly to people in need. We cut out the administrative time, we cut out administrative costs, and there's a lot that we can do for one another.
Karen also wants to know what the job market is like in Peoria.
Oh, well, we run a clean energy workforce development program. So there is a lot of opportunity in the healthcare industry, in the clean energy industry. But of course, we also have Caterpillar, but we also have a very large incubator where we have multiple startups. I would say if you want to start a business, if you want a job, but I work remote, it's a great choice.
So we're coming to the end of our time. Where do you see the Peoria housing market going 5 years, 10 years down the line?
I hope to see more people who plan to stay and who want to participate in increasing our election turnout for local elections beyond 10%. But we're breaking records now, and I just hope it continues. People who are engaged and excited.
Angie Ostashevsky is a clean energy professional, and you can also find her on TikTok posting about the Peoria housing market and maybe in trying to entice you to move there. Angie, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We'll be right back. That is all the time we have for our program today. I should mention Monday is Groundhog Day, and the movie of that name means a lot to the Illinois city where it was filmed. That's Woodstock, Illinois. We'll talk about how that came about and what the movie means to people with the man in charge of Woodstock's annual Groundhog Day festivities and Stephen Tobolowsky, who plays Ned, Needlenose Ned, in the movie. That's coming up tomorrow on The 21st Show. I want to suggest you consider joining our texting group. You can send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. We often send out messages about what we're working on for the show and ask for your questions and comments. We love sharing them with other people across Illinois. Again, you can join that by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Coulson Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. You can go to 21stshow.org and find a link to subscribe to our podcast or look us up on Apple or Spotify or YouTube, where we are wherever you listen. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.